Welcome back to The Fifth Estate, your fortnightly interview podcast from the Wheeler Center, hosted by anthropologist and writer Sally Warhaft. For our first episode of 2019, we're joined by Syrian refugee Qasim Eid.
Qasim Eid is a Palestinian-Syrian human rights activist, a rebel, a refugee, and an author. He's spoken around the world about his experiences fighting the Syrian government forces following the 2011 Arab Spring protests. He's contributed to the New York Times, to the Washington Post, to the Wall Street Journal. He currently lives in Germany, and he's written this book, which will be on sale after this event with Metropolis Bookshops. Thanks, Metropolis. Titled My Country, A Syrian Memoir. Any regulars to this series may have heard me say before that I just reckon about 99 out of 100 books should never have been written, let alone published. I find it really impossible to disguise when I think a book is average. This memoir is just terrific, and I can't urge you strongly enough to buy it and read it if you want a sense of what it is like to live through a civil war that is still going on. I couldn't put it down, and I couldn't believe what I was reading, even though, of course, it's something we all read about and hear about on an almost daily basis. We are so grateful, Qasim, that you could come all the way from Germany for a week in Australia to come and share your story with us. So please welcome Qasim Eid. The subtitle of your book, A Syrian Memoir, you've said that, not your memoir, and your love of Syria is just this unconquerable part of your story. So let's start with you telling us a bit about the Syria that you love.
First of all, thank you so much for coming, and thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor and privilege to actually be here. My father and my mother's family were originally from Palestine. They got kicked out in 1948. My father's family went to Syria and stayed there as asylum seekers. We were kept under refugee status ever since 1948. My mother's family went to Jordan, and they gained Jordanian citizenship. Later on, my father and mother met in Jordan. They got married, and they moved to Syria. I was born in Syria, in Damascus. Actually, I was born in a church, even though I'm Muslim, on Easter Sunday. Yes, and that's just an example of Syria, that it's so diverse, it's so full of history. Damascus is the oldest capital in history. We have the oldest languages, the oldest musical tone. We have a lot of history. We have a long history of people from all over the world, different religious and ethnic background, living all together. So I was living in a small town called Mount Damiyah. It's practically considered the western entrance of Damascus. We're literally 6-7 kilometers away from Damascus downtown. Mount Damiyah was a very small, beautiful town. A lot of olive trees, a lot of nice people. I spent my childhood playing around, chasing horses and goats and jumping over trees and playing hide-and-seek with my friends, going with picnics with my family. But in the same time, we were living in a big prison. The Assad dictatorship has been ruling Syria since the 1970, when Hafez al-Assad took by force, with a military coup, the rule of Syria. And he established a police state, a brutal, vicious police state. In 1982, for example, we had an uprising in Syria. It was labeled as also a bunch of terrorists who they want to kill. They labeled those people who refused to vote for Hafez al-Assad's re-election as terrorists. And Hafez al-Assad and his brother Rifat committed a horrifying massacre, killing more than 50,000 people, displacing hundreds of thousands of people, and sending thousands of them to the slaughterhouse in Saydnaya and in Tadmor prison, where nobody heard about them ever since. So that was an example the Assad family wanted to set for all Syrians to understand what it might cost you to say no, just to say no, or to have an opinion of your own. I grew up in a house with almost 10 siblings. We literally had our own soccer team. And as a kid, I used to read Reader's Digest magazine. My late father, who was a writer and a poet, he used to literally smuggle Reader's Digest magazine because it was forbidden, like anything else that will give you another perspective about life or the world outside the Syrian prison. So I was fascinated while I was reading all those crazy stories about random people in America going to a mall and finding a big hard time to know what kind of toothpaste they want to buy, because in Syria we didn't have toothpaste, you know, it was a luxury. We didn't have toilet papers, we didn't have a lot of things. So I grew up with this fantasy of world beyond the world that I know. And this fantasy kept growing with me while I was growing in this big prison with others of millions of people like me. I'm not going to lie to you, our dream before the revolution for most young men was actually to leave Syria. Anybody who got a job contract, for example, in the UAE or the Gulf countries or anywhere in Europe, the States, we will literally congratulate him and throw him a big party and whatever, tell him go and never come back. But when the revolution started, our dreams changed. And unfortunately, we saw it's...
You were so hopeful when Assad came to power in 2000. You were still in high school. How long did it take for that hope to begin to unravel?
When Hafez al-Assad passed away in 2000, he literally gave the rule of Syria to Assad. It's like Syria is like a farm for them. It's not a country. They just inherited Syria to his son. Bashar, back then, he was almost 35 years old. He was a young man studying in England, studying, I think, eye medicine, like an eye doctor. And we all had this high hopes that this young, educated man who studied in the UK, in London, who might have embraced the Western values of democracy and human rights, is actually our president now. So we were all hoping that he's gonna take Syria into a better place, a little bit, you know, that place is hell. With years passing by, in the first couple of years, he opened up the economy, but he opened up the economy for his cousins because they open up new cell phone companies, new banks, new hotels, new everything. But everything was owned by his cousin, Rami Makhlouf, or his other cousin, Fawaz al-Assad. So it's just took, they were just financial fronts, you know, for the regime. It was very hard for us to adapt with this change because the so-called middle class got crushed. A lot of people got very rich and a lot of people got very poor. And with time passing by, the brutality, the madness of the security forces that everyone in Syria knows kept actually getting worse. We have a famous saying in Syria about the walls. The walls have ears. don't you dare to say whatever. Even you're in the bathroom, like if you're in the middle of nowhere, they planted fear in our heads since we were in school.
There's a beautiful description in the book where your father, after your very first day of school as a little boy, sits you down and answers all your questions because he doesn't want you asking them out loud anymore.
Yes.
When the Arab Spring sprung, what did you think was going to happen?
I never actually thought that the Arab Spring will actually happen. When the revolution started in Tunisia, we were watching the news. Then in Egypt, and we started whispering, me and my friends, that, do you think it's going to happen here? Like, we couldn't even believe that it might actually happen. But with time passing by, we found out that the bravest Syrians were actually the Syrian children who wrote the words of freedom on their school walls in Daraa. That's how the Syrian revolution started, by little kids who wrote the words of freedom on their school walls in Daraa in early March 2011. And those children were just like us, you know, living in the same prison. They were almost 12, 11 years old, and they were watching the news like we were watching the news. They wrote freedom on their school walls. Minutes later, the intelligence patrols showed up. They arrest them. They arrest other kids who had nothing to do with it. They take those kids to the Air Force intelligence. Believe it or not, little kids who wrote the words of freedom on their school walls were taken to the Air Force intelligence. I don't know what that has to do with that, but that's how Syria goes. Everything is controlled by the intelligence officers. They took those children, they tortured them, they took out their nails, they raped them, they burned their private areas. They did a lot of bad things to them. And when their families went to the intelligence forces and demanded their release, they started shooting at them. And that's how the revolution started. The first time I shouted freedom in Muqaddamiya, I felt like William Wallace in Braveheart, you know? I felt alive for the very first time in my life.
It didn't last long, though, did it? I wonder if you can describe how that feeling of hope and the descent into what became a war zone, and in Muqaddamiya, where you were, was such a central focus of what was to come. But when and how did that contraction around your place occur, that you're living in a war zone?
What people don't understand about civil wars, and I hope you will never have to experience it or go through it, it's the fact that your friend or your neighbor or your ex-colleague will carry a gun, or in our case, an airplane, a tank, chemical weapons, and start hitting you with it. People who you grew up with, you thought they were your friends, your neighbors, suddenly show all this brutality, this madness. And you just cannot understand how could someone hide all that hate for such a long time. Because I don't think any normal person, any normal human being will take pleasure in killing his neighbors or his friends or raping women in front of their families or burning children with acid. When I was watching for the very first time the first demonstration in Muqaddamiya with my own eyes, I found it surreal, you know. I just couldn't believe this is true. With time passing by, with protests growing, not just in Mount Damiya, all across Syria, the regime used a lot of firepower. They used all their filthy tricks, all their savage, brutal methods to try to stop us from going further. They used bullets, they used shotguns, machine guns in the beginning to shoot at peaceful protests. They arrested people. They raped women in front of their families. In fact, one time it was in front of my eyes, almost 2 months after the revolution started, a police patrol, intelligence patrol, stopped a taxi that had two women inside it. They took the women out in the middle of the street. They started beating them out for no reason, just a show of force. Then they took the women to a building entrance and they started raping them. And we were all hearing them scream. I was very ashamed of myself. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror for a time. But all what I thought about was my sister and my mother. That if it will happen to them, I don't know what I'm gonna do. It happened a lot. It happened to a lot of people that I know. The regime sent car bombs. One of the car bombs blew up right across the street of our house, more than 13 car bombs. And just for people to know, Mount Damiya is a very small town. You know, we had the population of around 70 to 80,000 people. But within a year after the protest started, after the revolution started, we had less than 15,000 people remaining. And that was back in 2012. Most people here know about the refugee crisis or what's happening in Syria, perhaps in 2014 or 2015, after ISIS was created and all those refugees started drowning in the sea while they were trying to make it to Europe. But it started a long time ago. And like I mentioned earlier, in the 80s, I think there's here in Melbourne a lot of Syrians who came to Australia, just like in America when I met them, and even in Europe, who left Syria in the 80s because of that. That was another refugee wave, but people don't know about. The regime kept using all this brutality. And I just couldn't comprehend or understand that this is real. The tanks has the Syrian flag on them, and they're bombing my school. The airplanes, they have the Syrian flag, but they're bombing our hospital. I just couldn't understand that this is real.
One of the most moving parts of your story and the way you write about it is what you're expressing now, and it's sort of the idea that I think when, you know, especially Australia, we're such a long way, we read about a conflict like the Syrian civil war, and I think you almost read it with a sense, well, it must have been inevitable, you know, that somehow this war was always going to happen, whereas when you tell your story, it's as unlikely for you as it would be for this to be going on in a city like Melbourne. And the horror of that transformation. Nothing, I suppose, was as awful as this one day in August 2013, the day of the sarin gas attack, which killed around 1,500 people in your town, including many children. And the way you describe what occurred on that day, that you were gassed, you were sprayed with water, given an injection, you were then given a vest, a grenade and an AK-47 for the first time in your life, and told to march down a couple of blocks and become a a fighter, and you write, "I felt a strange sense of power, as if I could eat tanks and spit fire." Tell us how you reflect on that day now.
I always describe that day as Judgment Day. You know, in the Bible, in the Quran, the Torah, God tried to explain to us how terrified we're going to be, how, like, the terror, the confusion that we will all have in that day. That's the closest thing I can describe August 21st, 2013 with. By that time, we spent almost 2 years under siege and bombardment by our own government. We were reduced to literally eating grass and olives, sometimes stray dogs, because we literally ran out of food. A lot of people starved to death. Children, women. The regime bombed the hospitals, so we only had a field hospital, basically a basement in a building. We had four doctors, two of them were actually dentists, and three medical students. That was our medical staff for more than 13, 14,000 people, with no power and nothing. On that night, me and my friends were doing the same routine, going to in the night to the forest, try to get some grass, some olives to eat, look for something in the rubble of the destroyed buildings, perhaps rotten bread or whatever we can find to eat. And that night, my friends went to sleep, I went to sleep. Around 5 a.m., I woke up for the morning prayer. I think that's what saved my life somehow. I woke up minutes later, I heard the sounds of alarms, the kind of sounds you hear in movies in World War II or like Pearl Harbor when there's an air raid or something like that. I never heard that sound before. And after spending almost 2 years under bombs and whatever, you get to know if it's a tank, if it's, that's bombing you, or it's an airplane or mortar or whatever they're using. I heard sound of strange missiles flying or whatever that's flying. Seconds later, it hit the ground. It didn't make an explosion as I expected because it was early. Like any strong explosion would have made a big noise, but it didn't. Within seconds, one of the missiles hit almost 40, maybe 50 meters away from where I was living. I was trying to figure out what's happening. Seconds later, I lost my ability to breathe. I felt like my chest was set on fire. My eyes were burning. I couldn't scream. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't do anything. I just dropped on the ground and I started suffocating. I pulled out all my strength and I just kept beating my chest until I managed to get a single breath. And it felt like someone was tearing up my chest with a knife or a dagger made out of fire. I started screaming, wake up. My friends woke up. The neighbors were already started to scream the same way we're screaming. We were trying to just leave and get dressed. Our neighbor knocked on the house. She had two of her kids suffocating, and she was suffocating as well, and she was barely able to just tell us, please help. And because of the shelling, the constant bombardment by the regime, we always used to keep women and children in the lower levels of buildings, in the basements or in the first ground, because it's safer for them from the bombs. But gas is heavier than air. So if you watched the videos back then, you would have noticed that most of the victims were women and children. And that's the reason, because we were trying to save them from the bombs, keep them in the basements, but when the gas hit, they got affected more than others because they were in the low levels. We got to the street. I saw Judgment Day. Men, women, children falling on the ground, suffocating. There's no blood. There's nothing. I couldn't understand if this is real. I was barely able to breathe to basically see 10 meters away from me. But I noticed that there was a boy laying on the ground. I ran to help him. And I've seen a lot of horrible shit. Things that I really hope you'll never see. But that was one of the most terrifying things in my life. Just the look on that little boy's face. His eyes were glassy. He was suffocating and he was making this horrible sound while he was trying to breathe. I started crying, started trying to give him CPR, whatever. My friend came. He got a car. It was packed with children. There was no room. I jumped in the trunk. I held the kid. It took us almost 2 minutes to get to the field hospital. And while he was driving, all I can see is the same scene repeated. People running, falling on the ground. And by the time we got to the field hospital, I was trying to get the boy out. And I just dropped unconscious. My friends took me downstairs. Like I mentioned to you, this is the field hospital basement with a couple of doctors, no medical equipment, no power, nothing. They had to deal with a sarin massacre. There was almost 600 to 700 people who got exposed to sarin in our town. In other towns, there was almost around 3,000 people. Almost 1,500 people got killed within 2 hours. I went to the inside. The doctors checked my pulse. I had no pulse. They thought I was dead. They put me with the dead bodies. Minutes later, my friends show up. They saw me moving somehow, still kicking. And they called the doctors. They came. They gave me atropine, CPR. They washed my body, whatever. I think it was God's choice that brought me back or whatever. I woke up not knowing my name, not knowing anything, not remembering anything. Just, I'm awake, but I'm not. I went out to the streets, my friends carry me. I was naked, just wearing boxers and trying to understand what's happening. Then the airplanes showed up and they started bombing the shit out of us. Was looking on the streets, looking in the sky, see the airplanes, see the bombs. I was standing there like a zombie. And then my friends show up. They try to talk to me. They slapped me, whatever, until I understood that this is real. They reminded me that my name is Qasim. And all what I thought about was, how could that happen? How could this be real? I couldn't understand. Then they started screaming that the regime sent their elite forces wearing gas masks and everything, and they're trying to invade from several sides, and they were calling for anybody who can fight to go and fight. Because we've been invaded before by our own government, and they committed a lot of terrifying massacres when they literally butchered people with knives and burned them alive a long time. So don't think that this brutality came out of nowhere. So they asked me if I can fight. And all what I wanted in that moment was to fight. I never fought in my life. That was the very first time I carry a gun. They gave me the AK, the vest, and the grenade, and they took me to the front lines.
This is the Free Syrian Army.
Yes.
And did you understand who it was you were fighting with at that moment?
At that moment, not much, to be honest, because I was barely able to understand anything. But I know the Free Syrian Army. In my town, at least, they were my friends at school, neighbors, teachers. Some of them were engineers. Some of them were random people farming. We didn't have any strangers. Like, the strangers that we had were people from a town called Daraya. It's like 1 mile away from us. There was a time where strange fighters in mid-2012 tried to come to our town. And we made it clear for them that we can take care of ourselves, because we didn't want people to come and do things we didn't want to do. So those were the Free Syrian Army fighters that I fought with, and I'm very proud to fight with, because they were people who were just trying to defend their families. I really hope nobody will ever get to this point in his life where your wife or your mother or someone is close to you get raped or tortured or killed by your own government. You can't go to the police because it's the police. You can't go to the military because it's the military. We kept asking for international protection for more than a year. We kept peacefully protesting for more than 9 months, up to a 1 year. And we kept asking for protection that never showed up. We were butchered and treated like cattle, even worse. And that was the only option for us, either to keep getting raped and tortured and slaughtered, or to fight back. And when we chose to fight back, and the regime knew exactly what they were doing, they made it very easy for us to get guns.
Believe it or not. Guns and cigarettes.
Guns and cigarettes.
Really interesting that.
Yes.
Yeah. They gave the cigarettes so that you didn't actually go completely crazy.
That's true. Mm. That's absolutely true. Like I said, this regime has a long history of doing things like that, especially when I mentioned about Hama. They did the same tactics with Hama. They besieged Hama. They bombed it. They did the same thing. They smuggled few weapons to some of the angry young men who got their families and their wives killed and tortured, so they can film them and tell the world, look, they're terrorists, and that's why we're fighting them. It's the same dirty trick. It's the same old book. And if you were following up the news of Syria in 2011, you will know for sure. You can Google that. You could see it. It's true. You can Google anything that I'm saying and make sure it's true. They called the old officers who were responsible about the Hama massacre when the revolution started, and they called them the old guard, who were Hafez al-Assad, his father's old generals, to exactly repeat what they have done in Hama. Those guys knew what they were doing. They arrested and killed and butchered all the civil society, all the civil movement leaders. I had a friend in Daraya. His name was Ghiyas Matar. I don't know if people know his name. This young man used to give roses and bottles of water to the soldiers in the early days of the revolution and tell them that we're brothers and sisters and whatever, we're family, we're not enemies. And his effort with other group were actually played a key role in having a lot of soldiers defecting and leaving the Assad army and joining the rebels and joining the Free Syrian army. The regime butchered Ghiyas and took out his throat, and they made sure that everyone in Daraya will know what they have done to him. They raped his family. They did all these horrible things to him. And at the same time, the very same time, the regime released a lot of ex-Al-Qaeda fighters who were in their prisons in Tadmor and Saydnaya. To go back a little bit in time, when the American invasion happened in 2003, the regime, and this is according to the U.S. intelligence, the British intelligence, you can see it's all over the news, and it was part of the reason why Assad was under siege or sanctions at that time. They were making it easy for Al-Qaeda fighters to go to Iraq. They actually armed them and gave them weapons and even gave them a ride right to the Iraqi borders. first of all, to flush out all the jihadists, and the second reason is to keep Americans in the mud, in the Iraqi mud, for a long time. So most of those fighters, after they returned or got captured by the Americans and sent back to Syria, to the Syrian prisons, those fighters were released in 2011 and 2012 by the regime. And at the same time, they were killing and arresting the civil society leaders who are leading the peaceful protests. They wanted us to carry weapons so they can use it as an excuse to use more firepower and to show the world or to tell the world that we're fighting terrorists. And unfortunately, that tactic worked.
Who do you feel let you down the most?
A lot of people. But the most, I think, is Barack Obama. You know, and I told you, I learned English from reading Reader's Digest magazine when I was a kid, because I just, you know, I was dreaming about this world beyond the prison. And, you know, America is America. And when Obama got elected in 2008, I literally cried out of joy. When I was watching his Cairo speech, I just couldn't believe that finally a man of color, African-American president with the middle name Hussein, became the most powerful man on earth, that eventually we're going to have someone who understands how it's like to be different, but to have the same values and the same dreams. And we thought that maybe for the very first time, things are gonna get better. But with time passing by during the Syrian conflict, in the first year when we were just peacefully protesting, more than 100,000 people got killed. Hundreds of thousands got arrested and displaced. Time passing by, we kept asking for protection, international protection, or at least a no-fly zone or a safe zone for civilians so they won't get their asses bombed. Nothing happened. And if at the end, in 2012, Obama made one red line for Bashar al-Assad, which is, do not use chemical weapons. I remember his speech. Any use or movement or whatever of chemical weapons will provoke a military action against the regime. So that was his only red line. The regime was allowed to use tanks, bombs, barrel bombs, torture, rape, acid, whatever the fuck they wanted, but not chemical weapons. So when the regime used chemical weapons in 2013, as much as it hurt us, as much as we were suffering and we were crying and we were devastated, the only thing that we had to just give a little bit of comfort to ourselves or tell the victims or tell their families that finally they will do something now. But then Obama broke his promise. He made that horrible deal with the Russians that he will spare Assad the military strike in return of Assad giving his chemical weapons, which of course didn't happen because according to the OPCW and the United Nations, the Assad regime used chemical weapons more than 100 times. 100 times the Assad regime crossed that red line. And that was the beginning of the end for the Syrian revolution, for the Syrian dream. And if you look back in the time, in 2013, when that attack happened, ISIS didn't exist. Al-Qaeda fighters in Syria, according to US intelligence back then, were less than 5,000 fighters. While the majority of the fighters, the opposition fighters, were labeled as moderate fighters, were almost 100,000 or even more. So this terrorist excuse. It didn't work back then. But within a few months, ISIS was created. And in my opinion, it was created because of the power vacuum that came after that broken promise. Because after that, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS, of course, was created, and a lot of other terrorist groups from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from other countries, started just flowing to Syria. Just the Iranians sent thousands of fighters, like publicly, the Russians sent their airplanes, and they were bragging that they have tested so far more than 200 kinds of weapons in Syria. You can check out, that's Putin himself bragging about it, using his fancy weapons against civilians. So that power vacuum that was created after that broken promise sent a really horrible, terrible message to the entire world that there's actually no consequences. If that was the only red line that was drawn and was broken 100 times, and the Americans didn't do anything about it. And unfortunately, if we like it or not, America is the police officer of this world until something changes. If America doesn't lead an effort to do something, nobody will. Nobody has the guts. So when he gave Assad that free pass, even the number of barrel bombs tripled, or I don't know how many times you can add to it. It all went south.
It felt to me too that moment created a kind of vacuum inside you, and you kind of unraveled is not the word, but that something profound changed within you. And the best word I could describe it would just be an utter surrender. Not even caring if you lived or died, and literally giving yourself over at a checkpoint, expecting to be arrested, tortured, put in jail, killed. What was going on in your head at that point where you just gave up and had to leave? You just had to get out?
You know,
It's just unbelievable, this story.
You know, when you look up for people, when you look up for high principles like democracy and human rights and all this bullshit, and you find out it's bullshit and it's only for number of people, it's only for people with privilege. When you know that you're actually not a human being, that's not how the world sees you, at least, that you're just statistics and numbers and collateral damage, you know, it's... when you know that there's nobody coming to your aid, when you know that you're in hell and the only way out of hell is actually death. I lost a lot of good friends, people way better than me. Really honest and brave people that the world will probably never know their names. But I do. And, you know, in that time, I used to remember even some of my friends, out of desperation, were trying to sneak through the woods. And most of the time they get captured, burned with acid or whatever, but they kept trying. And we used to feel sad in the beginning, but with time passing by, we used to celebrate in a way, or feel happy for whoever dies. You know, it was the only ticket out of this hill. So after that broken promise, after that red line in the sand, there was no hope, there's nothing, you know, unless, I don't know, Superman actually existed and he's going to come and, you know, save the day. But nobody showed up, and I buried a lot of good friends, but I never visited their graveyards. I always promise them, every time one of them will die, that I will only visit them when we win and when we make Syria a better place. When we have free elections and all this. And until now, I didn't visit them. But inshallah, one day I will.
We're going to go to questions in a moment, but you're living at the moment in Germany. You've been there since 2016, is that right? Yeah. And when we were backstage earlier, you showed me your, what do they call that
card?
Residency card. And it was not straightforward to get the visa for Qasem to come to Australia. And the reason why he showed me is card, and where it says, you know, nationality, there's just three crosses.
Triple X, like Vin Diesel, but without the muscles and the money.
So to be a refugee, to be living in a country that you had no connection to, it's where you've landed. What is that feeling in light of, I mean, every country's a bit different, the way it looks and treats and regards and the politics of refugees. Australia's got a very, very special relationship with this particular question, but every country does, Germany does. What's it like to be that triple X, to be living that now?
Well, I'm not going to lie to you. Sometimes it's cool to show someone that you're triple X. But besides that, everything else is bullshit, you know, like, I'm pretty sure I was born here on this planet, you know, I didn't come from outer space, so it's my family. We were born, like I mentioned earlier, as Palestinian refugees, so I was born a refugee. I never had a citizenship in my entire life until now. And we went through all this trouble to stay in our country and to be citizens, equal citizens. That didn't work. I left Syria in 2014. I went to the United States. I spent 2 years going from Congress to White House to United Nations and doing all those essays and articles and whatever. But then I left out of frustration that Obama is not going to do anything, and my expectations of Trump getting elected, which unfortunately happened. Then I went to Germany, where some of my siblings are, and I applied for asylum there for the third time in my life. And until now, I'm still a refugee with a residency card that might expire at the end of this year. And I don't know, perhaps I should make my own country. You know, there's like 70 million displaced people, according to the United Nations. Even in the last Olympics, they had a refugee team because we became a nation of our own. I don't know what to do, you know. Maybe go in the international waters and just live there with the whales or whatever. I don't know. But I lost so many chances, so many opportunities just because I don't have papers or I don't have money. I got admitted to Columbia University in America, but I didn't have $100,000 per year to pay as, you know. And I don't know. I really hope people understand and like appreciate the blessings that they have, especially here in Australia. You live in a beautiful country. You have all these amazing rights. And one of the most amazing rights you have here is voting. We paid more than 1 million people to give up their lives just to be able to vote. And when I see people either here or in America or Europe using their votes like assholes, I get very, very angry and sad because those people just don't understand the blessings that they have.
If you'd like to ask a question, if someone puts a microphone in your hand, start talking. Yeah. No, please, you're first.
Hi. Hi, my name is Saeed Al-Taba, and I'm also Syrian. I came actually from Hama through 1980, when the uprising that you just talked about. And I'm still statusless, exactly like you. I've been here in Australia for about 10 years and still statusless, no citizenship whatsoever. My passport was cancelled by the Syrian embassy actually here when I came to study a few years ago. I've got only one question to you, Qasim. What do you say for the people who are still with the regime?
First of all, welcome to the club. And for those people, like, you know, in 2011, 2012, 2013, we kept giving excuses to people that perhaps they didn't know, perhaps they're too afraid to do something. But after the chemical massacres, I stopped giving people excuses, you know. We can have different opinions over soccer or food or whatever, but when it comes about war crimes, when it comes about raping women in front of their families or chopping off people's heads or burning people alive or doing all this crazy shit, it's just about being good or evil, you know, just about having the minimum decency or the minimum of humanity. If you are still with this dictator who did all these horrifying crimes, him and his father, I wish God will give you guidance, but if not, I wish God will take you to hell someday.
Hi, I actually lived in Syria for 2 years and I've been back twice since the crisis started. So I've got a very different view to Qasim. And this question is actually for Sally, the Wheeler Centre and the audience. Since the alleged sarin attack in Damascus, distinguished scientists such as MIT's Professor Theodore Postol and award-winning US journalists such as the late Robert Parry have looked at all the available evidence related to the alleged sarin attack and have drawn conclusions which would lead one to doubt Qasim's testimony.
I'm sorry. Well, what's your question very quickly?
Can the Fifth Estate interview people who don't align with those forces which took us to war against the Iraqi people? And may we hear and debate at the Wheeler Centre thought-provoking challenges to US militarism, such as those that Martin Luther King presented in the year before his assassination?
What I'll say is this, that to suggest against all the evidence, credible, I mean, to say that the sarin gas attacks did not happen.
Can I actually answer this question?
Sure, yeah, you're our guest.
I spent the past almost 5 years of my life after I left Syria with the United Nations, with the OPCW, with a lot of Western governments and others, human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and many others who worked for many years to try to document and investigate the chemical massacres. They all concluded that was the regime who used the chemical weapons, that those people who got killed were actually real people, not staged fucking act like the regime is saying. There's a lot of propaganda. There's a war on truth. There's a war on facts. On facts, there's a war. And it's really sad for me every once and then when I meet people with opinions like yours who just don't acknowledge facts and who just like to run to their own universe of conspiracy theories and believe that everything that's happening is not happening. I really hope that you will actually open up your heart and your mind and try to see that those people who got killed are real, that we didn't fucking gas ourselves or we didn't just film this shit in Hollywood or whatever, what people are saying. I really hope that you will find the human inside you, because standing in the line, standing with a dictator, is something very, very horrible. And I don't know what to tell you. I really hope that one day you will find the truth.
And thank you. Yeah. I don't think anything much more needs to be added to that other than to say that myself and the Fifth Estate and the Wheeler Centre are just incredibly grateful that Kassem would come all the way from Europe and choose to share with us these experiences and to be able to hear them in the first person. The Wheeler Centre is so grateful that you are here. So thank you again for that. Next question.
I wanted to thank the Wheeler Centre and you two for an absolutely riveting discussion tonight. Kassem, I was going to ask you your view of Barack Obama's performance in Syria, in the Middle East, and you've answered it. Thank you very much for that. Can I ask, what do you think is the central problem in the Middle East which seems to result in the catastrophes that have occurred in the last 40 to 50 years?
Thank you so much for a very important question. In my opinion, like I mentioned earlier, people should just dig out history and find out that all the problems in the Middle East, all the wars that started, it started because of a French diplomat and a British diplomat who got drunk almost 100 years ago and started drawing lines on the map in the Middle East and creating countries that never existed after the Ottoman Empire was defeated. Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, Syria, they were all one country, but the British and the French decided to draw lines and play this monopoly game. And ever since, all the problems, all the wars that we had in the Middle East, it's because of those fake borders that was placed by two foreigners who have nothing to do with this land besides the fact that they have a big-ass army and they won the war and they can do whatever the fuck they want. So people think we're savages or we just like to fight with each other. But if you go back in time and try to understand how shit went south, it started from back then, in my opinion.
Well, we've seen a lot of that this week too with Pakistan and India. Yes. And lines just drawn without a great deal of meaning. It's our time has run out. I wish we had another couple of hours. There's so many other things I'd like to talk to you about. There's so much that we didn't get to that's in the memoir, My Country. And once again, I really am going to plug this book because it's remarkable. And again, that we didn't really even touch on the story of your exit from Syria and how that occurred. That there are days in your life, Kassem, these moments in time that are just they will stay with me forever, having read them once. I'm sure I speak for most people here, if not everyone, in wishing you just everything that you wish for yourself, starting with the opportunity as soon as it can possibly happen for you to be able to return to your homeland, which I know is all you want, and a safe and happy and prosperous life. And in the meantime, thank you for sharing your story and illuminating us in a land of incredible privilege. Thank you
so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Kassem Eid in conversation with host Sally Warhaft for The Fifth Estate. Like all of our interviews, this was recorded in front of a live audience at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. Catch up on over 100 episodes of this series at wheelercentre.com. And if you're a fan, give us a boost, leave us an iTunes review or tell a friend. Next fortnight, Sally will chat with John Hewson and Michelle Grattan about the upcoming Australian federal election. Until then, take care.